All right, today's session 4, class 10, November 28th, 2010. I have a quick quiz for you, and your quick quiz is to answer next week. So I'm going to let it be a quiz for you.
Okay.
Where in the Torah do we see Hanukkah mentioned or alluded to? So we'll see who brings back answers next week for a gold star.
I won't be here.
You won't be here next week? Oh, no. You can answer by email.
Okay. I will have email.
Okay. So I want to look at, because it's Erev Chanukah, I saved this mitzvah for this week, the precept of kindling the menorah in the sanctuary, and I have quite a bit of a hirsh to look at as well. So let's look at this. So mitzvah 98, 377, page 377. The precept of kindling the menorah in the sanctuary. To kindle the perpetual lights before the eternal Lord, as it is stated, Aaron and his sons shall tend it in Exodus 27:21. That is to say, he should tend the lamp before the eternal Lord. And this is the mitzvah of kindling the lights, which is mentioned in the Talmud. Now, it's interesting because the word in Hebrew is hatavat nerot, heniz keret begemara. So hatava does not mean lahadlik. It's not hadlaka.
To light.
Right, to light. It's not the word of lighting.
Hatava.
Hatava. So that means the goodening. It's from the word tov.
Oh.
Hatavat.
Hatavat.
Right. Hatavat nerot. So that's, it's translated idiomatically as kindling the lights, but the actual mitzvah, it turns out, is preparing the lights, which we'll see later on, but I just wanted you to see that word in Hebrew. At the root of the precept lies the fact that the eternal Lord, blessed be he, commanded us that a lamp should burn in the sanctuary to magnify the glory and splendor of the temple in the eyes of those who behold it. For such is the way of people, to attain distinction in their houses with burning lights. And the entire reason for the magnification in it is that a man's heart should become infused when he sees it with reverent awe and humility. We have said previously that through the good deed, the spirit is made worthy. Now, it's interesting that that's the quote that's given for this phrase, because this phrase we have seen previously. Let's see if I can find it. In Hebrew it says, "Kema'aseh hatov hechsher hanefesh," right? That the good deed, ma'aseh hatov hechsher hanefesh, koshers or makes appropriate the soul. It's in the middle of this paragraph.
I see it.
So it's interesting that it quotes mitzvah number 16, which we've quoted many times before. So here's a second quick quiz. Who remembers what that mitzvah is? That's the mitzvah of not breaking the bone of the paschal offering. It's in that mitzvah where it discusses the many different commandments of the paschal sacrifice. And one of the last ones is not to break the bone. Where he says, now you may, son, ask me why there are so many mitzvahs. Why does it make a difference to do all these things, not to break a bone? Really, Dad, isn't that too much? And if you ask me, that would be a foolish question, because God increased the mitzvahs for us because of this principle that ha'adam nif'al kefi pu'ulotav, a person is shaped according to his deeds. And so God created many mitzvahs so that we will be shaped according to our deeds. So there's lots of deeds to do to shape us. So it's interesting because that is ha'adam nif'al kefi pu'ulato. So that's just more of a parv statement. A person is shaped according to his deeds. Right? And here it's in the positive. V'ma'aseh ha'tov, in the good action, hechsher ha'nefesh, the soul is made kosher. So, and kosher here meaning strong, straight, appropriate, fit. So in here it's translated as worthy. So it's just interesting to see the different, the quote back to number 16, but it's a variation on that theme. Now this entire theme revolves about the basic point established for us, that all is postulated from the point of view of those who receive and respond to it. Although I do believe in truth that the masters of the mystic tradition possess in these matters distinguished wisdoms and wondrous hidden truths. Nevertheless, we as well shall write what appears to us in the plain meaning of the matters, all of our intention being for the sake of heaven. So he's saying there's a lot of illusions here in the whole lighting thing. He's saying in the plain manner that when you keep a light lit, it's not so much today when we just all take that for granted, but having a light lit is something of, it's an expenditure that you only do to take care of the inhabitants and possibly people on the outside too, to see a light in the distance, to have a home that's lit. It does create an impression on somebody that there is lighting in a home. So here's the home of God, the home of our relationship with God, really. And so you want to have a light lit. So that's the origin of the Ner Tamid. Now, what I'm just curious what your association with the eternal flame is in a synagogue above the ark. What does that mean to you?
To me, it represents the spirit of the Jewish people.
Okay.
I guess that when I think of it, I think of the fact that we always want to have light shining on the Torah, because it's always, I mean, I always think of it as above where the, you know, Torah is kept, and so we always want to have the light shining on it.
Interesting. What did you think of that?
Well, connection with God, that it's constant, that it's never ending.
Well, what about you?
Just illuminating the Torah. Providing also light, because years past there,
it might have been the only light that was there.
It's interesting because I had the totally wrong association, completely wrong. I mean, you're all much closer to the what it's saying here. Not that I thought this now, but I, certainly initially, probably for the first 10 or 15 years, I really thought of it, due to lack of understanding, as much more of like a memorial lamp.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
You know, as the Kennedy, though. Because that was my first thought before you said
connection to the Torah. Isn't that funny? I never thought of that.
I was thinking as Kennedy, because that's what they did. They had the eternal light with Kennedy.
And isn't that funny? I never thought of that. And if you think about it at Yad Vashem.
Right. So I think that's more how I was thinking about it.
You know, the memorial to the children, they always have
all the lights, right? And you light candles, and you light candles for your art. So for me, somehow there was that thought. Yeah, like that.
See, but to me that's...
that we've lost so many that it's always that we always are remembering. And I was completely wrong. So
to me, that feels a little negative.
Yeah.
I mean, and I always have viewed it as a real positive, like...
Right. No, I'm saying I was completely wrong.
No, I understand
completely
that.
Wrong.
I mean, it's interesting.
So I was just wondering if anybody else was as wrong as I was.
But in essence, I mean, you could think of the fact that we have a light for memorial purposes and all that as a very positive thing, too. It's not really a negative thing.
Right.
I'm just saying.
Right. So that is the concept of a Ner Tamid. That's why we light lights for people, is to show that they illuminated, that they went on. So there is a connection between a person's life and light and illumination, and why a soul illuminates in the world, and why we want to have this light in the Beit HaMikdash. So we have this eternal flame to show that it's from the temple that light goes out. And actually, the windows are also shaped opposite how they are for other houses. Now, again, ours are flat. But at the time, certainly in a fortified building, the windows were shaped pointing... pointing in, like that. Mm-hmm. Pointing in, so that you got maximum light going in, whereas in the Beit HaMikdash, it was the other way. It was the light, the idea was, the idea was that the light comes from inside and shines to the outside, so that the wider opening was facing in, rather than trying to bring the outside light in. This is bringing the inside light out.
Well, and does the burning bush have anything? Because that's the first time you know that.
You have the fire like that.
Yeah, that's what I guess what I think, connection with God.
That's interesting.
Because it's the fire that never goes out, it just keeps burning.
Right, yeah, that's interesting.
Same concept.
Is it the same concept, or is that
I think that's different.
I think of that as to be an open miracle to draw his attention.
Yeah.
You know, that it was meant to make Moshe look twice.
Right. Well, and the light in the Beit HaMikdash is something we do.
Right.
Right, but it's constant and never going. I guess that's why I'm thinking connection with God, that it's constant and never ending.
Except for we have to do it. Right, so that's a good point. It's the burning bush God did, but here it's a commandment that we have to make happen. So, and yet, there is this connection with Hanukkah where God made it happen for a while. So we have to look at that too. What does that mean? So we have this light that's supposed to be there to shed light in the temple. And to shed the light, to to bring honor and respect to the temple itself, because light helps awaken in us a sense of honor and respect for the place. So we've said that in many different places before about the temple, that we're supposed to have that sense. We want to create an environment in which that is awakened in us. And then, so it's lighting it. Let's look at the first, because it's interesting to see. We'll see what he actually has to say on it. That's quite fascinating, actually. So let's see. So just so you see, the part of the religious duty, what we're supposed to do here is to light it, and you even light it on Shabbos. It thrusts aside Shabbat.
Light Hanukkah candles first.
Right, this is not Hanukkah candles. This is the menorah.
Okay. Right.
A Hanukkiah, we call it, is because of the miracle that happened with the menorah. But this is specifically about the menorah, not about the Hanukkiah, not about Hanukkah.
So the Ner Tamid was originally a menorah?
Not, yes.
Not like one.
Correct.
Like we have it.
Right, that's correct. Okay. Right. So let's look at that then. So it's interesting to see. Okay, so we have this light, the kindling of the light thrusts aside Shabbos, like the animal offerings, for which a specific time was set, meaning you can still offer those, even though you can't kill an animal on Shabbos, if it's for the offering that you're supposed to do on Shabbos, then you can. And so it's thrust aside Shabbos also because it says Tamid, it's supposed to be near Tamid continually, as it is stated. And so it does thrust aside Shabbos. And so the part of the law is that half a lug of oil was poured into each light. For it is stated, from evening to morning it should burn. And the sages measured and decided that they gauged that this measure would be enough for the long winter nights of Tevet. So Tevet is the month that comes after Kislev, and that's the month of the longest nights and the shortest days. So if it has to go from evening till morning, that would be the longest possible time it would have to burn. So they decided that a half a lug of oil would be enough for that. And if it happens to be too much in the summer, that's okay. Right, if the sun remained, it didn't matter. So part of the religious duty of kindling the lights is the removal of the ash. Cleaning out the ash from the menorah and lighting it is a positive precept in the morning and in the afternoon. Removing the ash means that from every light which went out, one removes the wick and any oil that remains in the light, and he wipes it clean and puts in another wick and oil.
So did you just discard the old oil?
I guess so. And that's what it looks like.
Which seems very...
We don't do that with... It's interesting. We do that, but we don't do that with Hanukkah oil. There's a couple of things you can do. Some people say that it's a segula for healing. So some people save the leftover oil for rashes or anything on the skin that needs extra attention because it's this Hanukkah oil. Or you save it and burn it for mitzvah. You can't use it for other purposes than sacred purposes. So you could save it and burn it down. So you either light it the next night or you'd use it for Shabbos candles, something like that. But you're not allowed to just, I think, cook with it or something. Or, I don't know if you would, but maybe you would in days
when
we didn't have Costco. Yeah. Yeah, before you could just go and get what you needed. If a light did not go out, he fixes it in the middle of the, if the middle light went out, so that's the main light, that's really the Tamid. He kindles it from the fire on the outer altar. So there is this concept of transferring of fires, which I think is interesting, because we do that from Motzei Shabbos, we light two candles from the Havdalah flame, which is a custom in some circles. You know, we being Balchuvas just pick up these customs. So, but it is a custom for the, because in Sarah's tent, the light went from Shabbos to Shabbos. So there is a concept that the light from Shabbos should go till the next Shabbos. So you don't light them the whole week long to keep that light going, but that the end of, that the ending light of Shabbos should be, it should be the beginning of the next Shabbos. You light two candles from that, and it just like keeps that light going a little bit into the week, like bringing the light of Shabbos into the week. Yeah.
Oh, I never heard
so
of that.
Before we blow out the Havdalah candle or extinguish it, light two candles from that.
Really?
Set that aside. So this is interesting because this is also taking the light from a certain place. Like why not just take the light from anywhere? But here, if the middle light goes out, you kindle it from the outer altar. As for the rest, he lights one from another. He draws the wick over and bends it until the flame catches it. So that's interesting, too, because it has to be a long wick.
They had another light in there besides the menorah. They had this other light from the outer altar.
Right, so that at our altar is burning something. I don't know what. Yeah, I guess so. Or there's at least a
fire
going.
Well, or maybe
going.
There's an ash.
Yeah, fire going or an ash.
You can light it. You can light something.
Right.
Fire going all the time.
Right. I mean, right, because at that time they didn't have matches, so they did keep fires going. That's one of the phrases in Eshet Chayil. Who is a woman of valor? And one of the verses is, Lo yechbe b'layla nera, that in the middle of the night her light doesn't go out. So on that, what does that mean? It means two. It means two of the many meanings, I'm sure, are one on the straight-up shot level, that she gets up in the middle of the night to tend her coals so that she'll have light in the morning, so that her fire doesn't go out. That does, right, that does require tending. So a good housewife will make sure that she doesn't have dead coals in the morning. It would be a busha to have to go to a neighbor's house and get a light because you blew it, right? So you get up in the middle of the night, lo yechbeh b'layla nera, her light doesn't go out in the middle of the night. So that's the pshat level. And then on an allegorical level, who is that woman of valor? One who goes through very dark times, and the light of her emunah doesn't get extinguished because of it. Right? That her light is not extinguished in the night. So, right. So we all go through night periods. But the Eshet Chayil keeps her emunah burning even during the night.
So all the lights, all eight, are supposed to stay all the time.
It's actually seven.
Well, seven plus the shamas.
Not in the temple. The menorah
is nine. It's eight plus one.
All right. So what you're confused about is that we loosely loosely use the word menorah for what we use on Hanukkah, which is a Hanukkiah, right?
Right. But it's
that has eight plus a shamash.
Yes.
Yeah, so but the menorah had seven. The menorah and the temple.
The shamash.
It's not a shamash.
It's not a shamash.
Mm-mm.
Oh, even though one's taller, it's not considered.
No, it's not a shamash. No. And I don't think it's taller. I think it's the same. It's just the center one. But it's not a shamash. The idea of the shamash is that it serves. Shamash means servant, right? So the shamash serves either by, it's a helper candle, right? Either by lighting the other candles, or the actual real reason for the shamash is that the Hanukkah lights are holy and you're not permitted to use them for their light at all.
Right.
So you can't read by it, you can't even walk by it, you can't even use it to like step over a toy. You can't use that light. So in our home, it's not a big deal. The light is hardly anything compared to our electric light. But imagine without electric light, that'd be quite an amount of light. Mm-hmm. So you light one extra candle that if you do come to use that light for any reason, that's the light you're using, is the shamash's light.
Okay.
Right? But you can't use the light or the flame of any of the other candles. So if another Hanukkah candle goes out, you don't light from that light, you light from the shamash.
Right. Yeah, so the other ones, but it's not considered six plus one, it's considered just seven.
Correct. That's correct. That is correct, right.
Okay.
Right, that's correct.
Yeah, it had to be even. Well, that's why I guess I thought the center one was taller, because it's three on each side and then the one.
I don't think so, yeah. I'm trying to remember the picture of it. I mean, if you think about it in Titus's arch, it's this shape, you know, and so it's all one.
It's all one.
Yeah.
Because the shamash, I thought, was supposed to be taller than the other ones, right? Otherwise, it's not considered a kosher.
I think it just has to be separate.
Yeah.
The rest have to be even. The eight have to be even. I don't think the shamash has to be taller, but it is.
Okay. Yeah, I thought someone had told me that it's not kosher.
It would be kosher without a shamash. You don't have to have the shamash, but that's why we use a shamash for that. But the actual Chanukiah would be kosher without it.
Oh, okay. So. And then you just use the other lights to light each other?
You can use anything to light. You could use a match to light each one.
Oh, okay.
Right? You don't have to have a shamash, but that's our custom, is to have a shamash, A, to light, but B, to provide the light so we won't to be sure that we're not using the light from the menorah for anything.
And is that the same thing as Shabbat candles too, that you can't use those?
No, you can. You have to use those for light, actually.
Oh, Shabbat
candles. Yeah, right. That's because they bring peace into the house. Why do they bring peace? So allegorically, there's all kinds of peace they bring in because you're doing mitzvahs and you're bringing light into the world and blah, blah, blah. But on the physical level, you're bringing peace into the home because now you can see stuff and you won't trip and hurt yourself.
Oh.
So it's straight up about peace like that. So you are supposed to use that light. You're supposed to gaze at it. It provides a refuah to gaze at it. So you're supposed to look at them. So you want to just take some time after you light them. either in the moment or during the meal or whatever, just to glance over and take them in. It is considered a healthy thing to see the lights of Shabbos. Okay, now I want to look at this Rav Hirsch. Let's see, 431 and 430. That's the wrong direction. Do I have
the wrong direction?
First, I want to look at 509 and 510.
Oh, okay. So that is okay.
Yeah, that's the first one. Okay, so just so you know, this page, because it's two pages in Rav Hirsch that aren't facing each other, I photocopied them separately and made them face each other.
Very clever.
So I wouldn't waste paper. But also I did it in the 509, 510 direction, which is not the way Rav Hirsch goes. So you'll see for the other ones, you have to read the other direction. Because he writes, it's a Hebrew book, not an English book. But here, I did it this way. Okay.
Just to confuse us. Just right. To see if we're weak.
Right. So there's really great stuff here. So I really want to read, we have the time, if you don't mind, I really want to read it.
The
whole thing, because, yes, let's read it. So there's two essays here that are really interesting. We probably won't get to the whole second one, but let's read part of it. So how about somebody else does some reading?
Okay.
Verse 20.
And thou shalt...
Yeah. Oh, you can read the pasuk too, why not?
Okay. Thou shalt command the children of Israel that they take for thee pure olive oil, pressed for lighting, and to make a light shine out continuously.
So it's from that verse we just read, the chinuch.
Okay.
Right.
We have already remarked above on chapter 25, 6, that there, oil for lighting, is reckoned amongst the articles which were to be donated for the establishing of the Mishkan. The fact that the oil and the
ketoret,
which
is the spices, the spice offering,
which is also mentioned there, both of which really belong to the
avoda, the holy service
of the Mishkan, rather than to the Mishkan itself, are mentioned in that list, expresses the idea that these two, the one representing illumination and clarity of the mind, and the other complete sublimation of all actions to make them something that is pleasing to God, together express the whole aim of that ennoblement of man for which the
Mikdash
is to work, and so they do belong essentially to that which the Mikdash itself represents. In the
Avoda,
mm-hmm. two, we find
Nerot, candles, right,
and
Ketoret,
intimately connected with each other. Here it cannot speak of Ketoret as the making of the
Ketoret
has not yet been ordered. By bringing the service of the light here, immediately following the orders for building the sanctuary, and even preceding the instructions for the priestly garments, two things are indicated. On the one hand, Avodat Hanarot, the care of the lights, is the duty which in point of time is to take precedence over all other duties, as the clearness of mental vision which is to be derived from the Torah is the mother of keeping the dictates of the Torah.
Gadol tamad shemei vi liyidei ma'aseh. Great is the Torah that brings to behavior, brings to action.
And on the other hand, that the essential mission of the
Kohen
is nurturing the enlightenment that is to be derived from the Torah.
So did you get that so far? So it's fascinating. We're going to see more of
so the they talk about this even at the very beginning, before they even talk about the light and the kindling, before they even go into some of the other details.
Right. That this is what he's going to postulate here. What he says here is that these articles, which are to be donated, look at the third sentence. The articles, the ketoret ingredients and the oil were to be donated on the list for establishing the Mishkan.
To create it,
not the things it takes to run it. It's not like flour for the mincha offering or for the showbreads. It's not the same thing, because here you might think oil for lighting the menorah is like flour for the showbreads, right? So it should be on a separate list. It should be on the list of ingredients you need for avoda, not stuff you need for the establishment of the Mishkan. Right? Do you understand those two lists?
Mm-hmm.
So one is what you're doing in it, and you need stuff to do what you have to do inside, and the other is the actual establishment. So the oil for the kindling of the light, the ner tamid, and the ketoret, the spice offering, both go on the first list of the actual establishment, which is going to show us something different in terms of the quality of the mitzvah itself. What is that mitzvah? That it's essential to the essence of, essential being the essence of the thing, that actually lighting the menorah is about the essence of the Mishkan. It's not about the avoda that goes on in the Mishkan, in the sanctuary. It's about the actual essence of what it's about. And
so
then
it has to be there or there wouldn't be a Mishkan,
that's right,
versus what you do in the Mishkan.
Right. Well, it's not that it has to be there or there wouldn't be one, because we're not talking about the actual building itself, right? How do you build it? Because we are talking about how you build the building. Yeah, you need bricks and mortar, whatever it is. You need the stuff to build it. And if you don't have certain things, it won't be built. But that's not what it's talking about when you talk about the essential nature of the building in this case. The Mishkan itself is that physical structure that we engage in building in order to fulfill our purpose in this world. So the building itself, creating that building, is about us becoming perfected as human beings. It's not about like a shul, like this, is not the same thing. Building the building, the purpose of this building is only to hold what goes on inside of it.
And that's part of...
Whereas the purpose of the Mishkan, of building the Mishkan, is to bring us to perfection through actually building it.
The building of it is part of
the perfecting of the person. Right? It's a different concept. So that's why... So that's what it's saying, that the care of the lights takes precedence over all other duties. So now it's making an equation between care of the lights and mental vision. Clearness of mental vision, which is to be derived from Torah, is the mother of keeping the dictates of the Torah. You can't keep the Torah if you don't get it, and if you can't see it. So the kindling of the lights is essential to all other behaviors. You have to have clarity before you can do it, right? So that's what the menorah is about, is that mental clarity that allows you to see what you're supposed to be doing in the rest of your life. And it talks about the essential mission of the Kohen. What is the essential mission of the Kohen? He's supposed to be doing all those things. He brings the sacrifices, he runs the Beit HaMikdash, but what is his mission? Nurturing the enlightenment that is to be derived from the Torah. That's his mission, nurturing the enlightenment. So that's also important. We're going to see in a few minutes at the end of this, and that's why this is so important. And this will point out a huge difference between us and other religions as well. But this is just your first clue right here. The mission of the Kohen is nurturing the enlightenment that's to be derived from the Torah.
Where is that line?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5
up. Yeah.
4 or 5 up from the bottom of the first paragraph.
Okay, and then we have this. Siftei Kohen Yishamru Dat V'Torah Yivakshu Mepihu. Right, so the lips of the Kohen guards the knowledge of the Torah. You should ask from his mouth. Okay, so let's keep going. You want to keep these points are necessary? Want to read from there? Anybody?
Okay.
Esther? Yeah, okay, go on. Great.
What is the reference there? Malachim? Is that what
that is? I guess so. M-A-L? I would think, yeah. Malachim 2? No, it's got to be...
There's
a Malachim Beis, so that, but that's got to be... I mean, it's probably pointing out a Pusik, so maybe it's Malachi.
Oh, that could be too.
Did you want to read?
No, go ahead.
Okay. These points are necessary for the understanding of the meaning of the priestly garments, the instructions for the making of which immediately follow in the succeeding verses.
Which we're going to look at after we finish this part, yeah.
Titzaveh
et
bnei Yisrael. Thou, as the transmitter of the Torah, the study of which is a very first duty for all time, is to be represented by this care of the lights.
Titzaveh. Command.
Command. Put it before them as a special duty. The sages of the Gemara remark that the titzaveh is used where special emphasis is to be laid on the seriousness and importance of a duty which is incumbent immediately and also for all time.
Miyad ulidarot, so that's immediately and for all time. So this is a commandment that's for immediately and for all time. Like some commandments are just for the moment. You know, hold up your rod so the sea splits. That's just a in-the-moment commandment, right? But there's also forever commandments. Make a Pesach Seder. That's a forever, right?
So, miyad, is that from hand?
Miyad is from hand, but it means immediately. Miyad is immediately. And lidorot is for the generations.
Door by door. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And above all...
Biyoder sheyesh bo chisaron kis. Okay, this he does translate what that means.
Where it is a question of sacrificing material wealth for spiritual ends, the profit of which does not seem to be immediately apparent, et b'nei Yisrael, and repeated also in verse 21, ma'ot b'nei Yisrael, the care of looking after the spiritual education is to be the responsibility of the general community, not the special prerogative of the priestly caste.
Okay, just get that sentence here. That's important to understand. The care for looking after the spiritual education is to be the responsibility of the general community, not the special prerogative of the priestly caste. Right?
So the priestly caste has their specific duties and obligations, but this isn't one of them.
Well, they have their specific duties and obligations, and fixing up these lights, Hatzavat HaNerot,
right,
is definitely one of them.
But the spiritual education is everybody's job.
It is everybody's job, because here we see the job of the Kohen is nurturing the enlightenment. But does that mean they're supposed to hold the enlightenment? Should they be the ones that say, we'll study the books and tell you what to do?
Or
do they empower you to study the books,
so
because it belongs to everybody?
Really huge difference.
You'll see, so as we get to the bottom. This is huge.
That's why, historically and traditionally, it was very important for Jewish people to learn how to read.
Yes.
As compared to all other groups, where only the very wealthy and only the boys and only the this and
exactly.
the that learned to read.
Exactly.
We had almost
universal literacy throughout the ages.
Right.
Yeah. Even amongst the poor. And it's interesting. There were different chevra mishnayos of learning groups that were often divided by profession. There would be the wagon drivers learning group and the water carriers learning group and the whatever there was. They got together and they learned in their off times. They worked, but they learned because the spiritual education is the responsibility of the general community and not the special prerogative of the priestly caste. Yeah, want to continue?
The oil of the nation is to be offered for the light of the Torah and the menorah. Represents the tree of the national spirit, not that of the priests. It is highly characteristic that it is only Hatavet Narot, the daily provision of the means for obtaining light, and the conditioning of the lamps and wicks to produce a clear, bright light, that is the real
Avodat Kehuna, the real priestly work.
The actual lighting might, if the necessity arose, be performed by a non-priest, a layman.
Hadlakat Lav Avodahi. Right, so this is a principle. So that's why I pointed out the word hatavat hanerot.
Right.
The hatavah must be done by a kohen, preparing. But the actual lighting is not kohanic. It's not a kohanic mitzvah. It's a mitzvah on the whole nation that has to be lit. And if the necessity arose, if there's not a kohen there to do that work, anybody can do it. There's some things that if there's not a kohen there, it can't be done. But here, if there's not a Kohen there, the Kohen work has to be to prepare it, but a layperson, a Yisrael, can do the lighting because of the fact that the oil of the nation is to be offered for the light of the Torah. So we have to see what the oil of the nation means. And the menorah represents the tree of the national spirit, not that of the priests. Right? So this is something that belongs to everybody. Want to keep going? Okay, great.
Vayekach Alech.
Right.
Even when you use it, it is to remain theirs. You are only the
treasurer.
The treasurer for it. What's that word in Hebrew?
Gizbar. I wrote it down on one of them.
Zion. Okay.
Yeah, Gizbar.
Gizbar.
Yeah.
For it and its use is made in their name. Mezot Shemen Zot Shemen Zot.
It's Shemen Zayit. Shemen Zayit. Mizeto. Shemen Zayit. Shemen Zayit. Zach Katit. So Mizeto. So what is that? That kind of olive oil. So it's giving you, it's telling you. Right.
Zayit
oil. Right.
Zayit.
Shemen
is
oil.
Shemen is oil.
And Zayit is olive.
Right.
So Mizeto. What does that mean? So now it's going to say, what does that mean? Mizeto means?
Ripened on the tree. It means ripened on the tree. Become oil on the tree. Kitat. Pressed, extracted from the fruit by pressure alone, but not by
grinding.
Okay, crushing or grinding in the mill. Lima or the very best, finest, purest oil which was obtained in this way was only required lima or for lighting, for menuhot. All these refinements were not necessary.
So there's two different types of oil then that are used in the temple. One is for lighting the menorah and the other is for mincha offerings, which include flour and oil in the offering.
Okay.
So the oil for lighting the menorah has to be extra, extra pure and special. It had to have ripened on the tree and then only be extracted by, I guess, cold pressing, right? Just a pressing that it should come out. No grinding. Whereas, so you're not getting much and you're only getting the tip-top, highest quality oil that way. That's not the case for mincha offerings. All those refinements are not necessary. You could grind it in the usual way and get regular olive oil for mincha offerings. But that's what Shemen Zait Zach is. Zach means see-through. Zach, Zain Chaf, is the root that we use for modern Hebrew today. Zchuchit, which means glass. Right, Zach. Zach means clear, right?
And mincha, what's a mincha?
Mincha.
Minucha is like rest.
Minucha is rest, right? Mincha is an offering. So it's a type of, it's a specific type of offering. It's not an animal offering.
But it means offering?
It means offering. Yeah.
So how does that connect then to rest offering?
It's a good question. Minucha. Yeah, I'm not sure. It's a very good question. Okay, here's my favorite piece right here. Who's going to read that? Esther, you want to read that? L'ha alot ner? Shall I read? Okay. This expression, so l'ha alot ner, because where does it say that? It says in the pasuk here, Shemen Zait Zach Katit L'ma'or L'ha alot ner Tamid, right? That's what you're supposed to do. You command the children of Israel and take for you Shemen Zait Zach Katit for light L'ha'alot ner tamid, to l'ha'alot ner. So this expression for kindling lights occurs only with reference to the service of the menorah. Right? Because what is that l'ha'alot ner? That's not what we say. We say l'ha'adlik ner, right? What's l'ha'alot ner? It is the precise description of the demand to keep the kindling flame against the wick until the latter burns by itself. Shetehei shel hevet olah me'alaha. Until the flame starts to burn on its own. The work of a Torah teacher is to make himself superfluous, not to keep the laity in lasting dependence on teachers or priests. At the same time, it is an admonition to enduring patience for teacher and pupil. Right? So that's what l'ha'alot ner means. The teacher, the Kohen or the Torah teacher, either one, is supposed to take their light and put it next to the wick as long as is necessary. That's the patience. So it depends on the individual wick. However long you have to get that light to burn on its own. But then it's burning on its own. You're supposed to pull back. You're not supposed to be in the picture anymore. You're supposed to empower and allow a person to draw on their own oil, their own pure intellectual sustenance to burn their own light in the world. So that's why I think this is so, I love Rav Hirsch. Right? Isn't that gorgeous? Mm-hmm. And so that's what the light in the Beit HaMikdash is really, is the intellectual light of the Jews, the intellectual / spiritual light of the Jews shining into the world. So it is about what we're supposed to be accomplishing. So let's see. Right, we're supposed to be a light unto the nation. So what does that mean, a light unto the nation? Right, so I'm going to, because we don't have a ton of time, I want to just, should we just cut to the chase of this article? It's such a nice, this is also a nice long article. This is what is referenced, this second piece, is what's referenced in the beginning of the first piece. Right? It says we've already marked above in chapter 25:6. So here's chapter 25:6. Okay, so this is a nice long article. That's the second page. Oh, I have 2 second pages. That's why.
Oh, so do I.
You have 2 second pages?
428 and 429.
Yeah, you have
Yeah.
You have 2 first pages.
Oh.
Yeah, right? Yeah. That's the second page. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So this should be what's first. So I did a little, and now we're back with the reverse that goes the opposite direction, okay? And so I just wrote in hand letters here, just because you're missing that first sentence. I didn't think anybody was actually going to look up in our treatise in Yeshurun, that's a J-E-S-H-U-R-A-N, entitled, however this is, because it's in German, Gründeliner einer Jünheisen Symbolik. We've worked out very thoroughly and provided the symbolic nature of the tabernacle as a whole and of the materials used for it in detail. With regard to the explanations which follow here, we will refer our readers to that article which discusses thoroughly the question as to whether all these things really are symbolic, inasmuch as here we are taking as the basis for our explanation of the text the results we obtained there. So he's now assuming that you're going to turn to that article and read the whole thing. I don't know where to find that article, but could look someday when I get the collected writings of Rav Hirsch, but so far I just have this. So he's talking about, first he wants to talk about the concept of building that Mikdash. So let's look at this second, because we don't have, I recommend that you read the whole thing if you can, but let's look at the second paragraph on page 428, which is really the third paragraph. If then, our text does nevertheless promise v'shachanti b'tochem as a result of v'asu li Mikdash, then evidently the meaning of Mikdash can be nothing else but the expression of all that is required of us to bring about the promised Shekhinah presence in Israel. So let's just go back to the sentence for a minute. So he was talking about this pasuk, this phrase, build for me a Mikdash and I will live in you. Right? It should be I'll live in it. Right. Build for me a sanctuary and I will live in you. Mm-hmm. So that's the famous phrase that we've discussed before, and that's why, based on that, is why I said the building of the building itself brought about the perfection of the people. Because here it's saying there is a promise. If you build this Mikdash, then the promise is, I'll live in you. Right? So if you do what's necessary to make this building happen, I promise I'll live amongst you. So if that's the case, if there is that promise, then it must be that a Mikdash can't be anything else but the expression of all that is required of us to bring about the promised Shekhinah presence in Israel. Right? So if we get Shekhinah presence living among us, then building the Mikdash must be everything that's necessary to make that happen. So with Va'asuli Mikdash, V'shechanti B'tocham, two ideas are given to us. And the whole building of the tabernacle and its future is to symbolize these two ideas. The idea of Mikdash and the idea of Mishkan. The one, Mikdash, is the whole of the task we have to do for God. And the other, Mishkan, the promises God has given to us if we do it. The task of Asuli Mikdash consists of our giving up of the whole of our private and public life to the fulfillment of the Torah. The promise, V'shachanti B'tocham, the protecting and blessing-giving presence of God in our midst, manifesting itself in the happiness of our private and national lives. The tabernacle is to be Mikdash, the home of consecration, and Mishkan, the home of God's proximity to us. From this home, we are to get inspiration for our own consecration and to gain the resulting reward, so that the sphere within which we have to try and find the meaning of the tabernacle as a whole and its component parts in detail is simply mutual covenant relationship between God and Israel, brought about by the giving and acceptance of the Torah. It is just because of this meaning of the tabernacle that this chapter of the building follows immediately on the preceding fundamental principles of the Torah and the resulting Brit covenant that was concluded thereupon. So looking from that point of view now, he's going to talk about all different things that are in the Mikdash, right? The wool, all the materials that he talks about. So there's now you have a page and a half of that. But let's go down to page 431, where we talk about the oil. The material mentioned in verses 3 to 5, do we have that here? Mm-hmm. No. Do I have that yet? Just so I can read you that. That's 25. Oh, there's a whole long essay on the menorah too. It's amazing. There's so much good stuff in here. Get back there. Okay, so verse 3 to 5 is, And this is the truma that ye shall receive from them, gold and silver and copper, sky blue wool, purple, scarlet wool, fine linen and goat's hair, and ram skins dyed red, tahash's skin and shittim wood, oil for lights, spices for anointing oil, and the spicy incense. Okay, so that's part of the list of stuff you need, okay? The material mentions in verses 3 to 5, which is before the oil, are co-joined by a couple vav. They all belong together as being the material out of which the actual building and its contents were to be made. Verse 7 mentions precious stones, which I didn't read, which are required for the outfit of the priests, so that the priests and their garments are included as an essential part of the sanctuary itself. They are part of the clay mikdash, as Rambam too classifies them in a spiritual sense in the Yad Chazakah in his Mishneh Torah, and as we shall have to realize when we come to the study of the laws regarding the sacrifices. We shall see how the priests themselves, especially the high priest, and their garments serve symbolically in quite a similar way to the temple itself for the minds of the people. Surprisingly, verse 6, oil for the lights and spices for the anointing oil and for the incense are also mentioned. Now, Shemen HaMishcha, the anointing oil, does not really belong in the real sense to the Mikdash, but as it is essential for the consecration of it, because it was also poured on the vessels of the Mikdash, not just on the people, and its contents, and as they are really only inducted into the character which they represent by being anointed with it, we can understand it's being included amongst the rest of the constituent materials. But oil for lighting and incense seem only to belong to the category of materials necessary for the service in the sanctuary, like flour for the showbread, wood for the fire on the altar, lambs for the daily offering, etc. And their being reckoned amongst the materials to be subscribed for the building of the tabernacle is striking. Nevertheless, if, as we shall have to show, the spiritual life we are to lead, inspired by and directed to the Torah, finds its expression in the sanctuary, in the burning of the lights, and the achieved ideal of all sacrifice to God, the complete sublimation of self to be pleasing to God, is the meaning of the burning of the incense, then the mention of these immediately with the gifts for the building tell us that the establishment of this building is to achieve the two highest aims of human existence. That is to say, clear, true enlightenment, the goal for one's mind, and being pleasing to God, the goal for one's acts. Mm. Right, so that's what the oil and the spice is about. Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, that's really neat.
So, yeah, I think it's just lighting a menorah, when the truth is it's really something amazing. So it is for this reason, especially if you're not going to be here, I just have to remind you, it is for this reason that the miracle of Hanukkah, that the whole point of the Hanukkah story is that they were looking for this pure oil, right? Because they talk about how, you know, the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and they went in and they cleaned it up, and they wanted to find oil to relight the menorah. So, A, it wasn't destroyed. The Greeks had a very high aesthetic sense. They would never knock down anything or destroy a holy temple. They just sacrificed to their gods in it.
So they desecrated it.
They desecrated it, but it wasn't destroyed. They didn't have to go clean it up. But the, as we'll hopefully go into a little bit more next time, this exile was a different exile than all other exiles, the Greek exile, in that we were in our homes. It was an exile of the mind. So what were they looking for? They were looking for pure olive oil to relight the menorah. Why pure? It wasn't necessary. They didn't need pure olive oil. It was after a war. Everybody was tamei mate. Everybody had the impurity of death on them. They couldn't make pure olive oil appropriate for the kindling, except for they didn't need to because it was in a time when you didn't need to. Everybody was tummy mate. They could have lit for a week with regular olive oil, but they didn't want to. They wanted to find one, at least some pure oil. Why? Because the pure oil represents the intellect of the Jew. So what they were saying is, we've gone through this Hellenistic period. Surely there must be some pure Jewish wisdom, untainted by Hellenism, somewhere in this temple that we could use to kindle that light from. That's what we're looking for, untainted Jewish wisdom. Shemen Zait Zach, that oil that allows us to see through into the true reality that it is these two things, the purity of thought and the purity of deed that we're here for. That's what we want to find. And that's what they were able to find. And that's the miracle of Hanukkah. Not, yes, that it lasted 8 days. Okay, that's the outside miracle. But really, the miracle is that we looked for it. That we wanted it at the end of this Hellenistic period. That we cared enough, that we understood enough, that what we want is pure Jewish thought to light this light from. So we'll go back on that next week, but I just wanted to make sure you got that before you before you leave. Good. You share it. Pardon?
This is the second temple, right?
Second temple time is the Hanukkah time. That's correct. Yes, that happened. Approximately 400 years BCE is the Hanukkah story. Approximately. I should get that number exactly. Next week we're going to do a Hanukkah class. So we'll make sure we get all those dates and things right. So, great. Okay.
Thank you.
Happy Hanukkah to anybody who won't be here.